generosity to the conquered, and firmness against aggressors. They marvelled at Anchises' words, and he went on, "Look how Marcellus comes all glorious with the highest of trophies, a victor overtopping all other men. He shall buttress the Roman cause when a great war shakes it, shatter the Carthaginian and rebel Gaul with his cavalry, give to Quirinus the third set of arms won in single combat." Aeneas interposed, seeing beside Marcellus a youth of fine appearance in glittering accoutrements, but his face was far from cheerful, and downcast were his eyes. "Father, who is he that walks with Marcellus there? His son, or one of the noble line of his children's children? How the retinue murmurs around him! How fine is the young man's presence! Yet is his head haloed by somber shade of night." Then Father Anchises began, tears welling up in his eyes. "My son, do not probe into the sorrows of your kin. Fate shall allow the earth one glimpse of this young man. One glimpse, no more. Too puissant had been Rome's stock, ye gods, in your sight, had such gifts been granted it to keep. What lamentations of men shall the Campus Martius echo to Mars' great city? O Tiber, what obsequies you shall see one day as you glide past the new-built mausoleum? No lad of the Trojan line shall with such hopeful promise exalt his Latin forebears, nor shall the land of Romulus ever again be so proud of one she has given birth to. Alas for the sense of duty, the old-time honour! Alas for the hand unvanquished in war! Him would no foe have met in battle and not rued it, whether he charged on foot or drove his lathering steed with spurs against the enemy. Alas, poor youth, if only you could escape your harsh fate. Marcellus you shall be. Give me armfuls of lilies, that I may scatter their shining blooms and shower these gifts, at least, upon the dear soul. All to no purpose, though such kindness be." So, far and wide, surveying all, they wandered through that region, those broad and hazy plains. After Anchises had shown his son over the whole place, and fired his heart with passion for the great things to come, he told the hero of wars he would have to fight one day, told of the Laurentines and the city of Latinus, and how to evade or endure each crisis upon the way. There are two gates of sleep. The one is made of horn, they say, and affords the outlet for genuine apparitions. The other's a gate of brightly shining ivory. This way the shades send up to earth false dreams that impose on us. Talking then of such matters, Anchises escorted his son and the Sibyl as far as the ivory gate, and sent them through it. Aeneas made his way back to the ships and his friends with all speed, then coasted along direct to the harbour of Caieta. Bow anchors out, the ships are lining the shore with their sterns. Book 7. Caieta, too, who was nurse to Aeneas, when she died, gave Italy's coast undying fame. For even now the place where she rests is preserved by her legend. She has an epitaph in a place name of Great Hesperia. No small glory. When the ever-faithful Aeneas had paid her the last rites and heaped a burial mound above her, the deep sea now being calm, he weighed from harbour and set course under sail. The wind blew steadily on into the night. A bright moon favoured their voyage, its radiance dancing upon the water. Soon they were skirting close by the shore of Circe's land, where that luxurious daughter of the sun, her song for ever thrilling through spell-protected groves, in her proud palace burns fragrant cedarwood during the night to see by, while the rattling shuttle runs through the gossamer warp. From this place could be heard, through the small hours, the groaning roars of angry lions, resentful at their captivity. Bristly boars and bears were heard from the enclosures, furiously raging, and wolf-like creatures howling. Men they had once been, but the terrible goddess had turned them into beast faces, things on all fours, with her magic herbs. So, lest the god-fearing Trojans touched at that fiendish coast, and putting in there, suffered the same weird transformation, Neptune, filling their sails with a wind from the right quarter, got them away and past the surf that boils inshore. Now was the sea's face blushing with dawn rays, and in heaven, rosily charioted, shone crocus yellow aurora. When the wind dropped, all of a sudden not one breath was blowing, and the oars toiled in water slow as syrup. Looking forth from the deep, Aeneas sighted a big wood. Through this wood, the genial stream of Tiber flowing, yellow with racing eddies that stir up sand galore, debouches into the sea. Around and above, bright-plumaged birds, whose habitat is the river banks and channel, charmed the air with their song, flitted about the wood. Aeneas ordered his squadron to change course towards the land. Soon, in high spirits, he entered the shady mouth of the river. Come, muse of love, let me rehearse the kings, the phase of history, and the conditions that reigned in antique Latium when first that expedition arrived upon the beaches of Italy. I'll recall what first led to the war there. Speak through me, then, spirit of song. Grim wars I'll tell of, and battle fronts, and princes courageous unto death, the levies of the Etruscans, aye, all Hesperia mustered in arms. A grander train of events is now before me, a grander theme I open. An old man now, Latinus, was king of the towns and country, his reign being long and peaceful. He was the son, we are told, of Faunus and the Laurentian nymph Marica. Faunus was son of Picus, who called Saturn his father. Yes, Saturn originated their line. Latinus, by fate's decree, had no son now. His male succession was no more, cut off in the bloom of first youth. One daughter he had, sole prop of his house and heir of his ample estate, a girl fully budded now and ripe for marriage. Many sought her hand from all over Latium, from all Italy. The handsomest by far of these wooers was Turnus. He had the prestige of a splendid pedigree, and the backing of the queen, who had set her heart on getting him as a son-in-law. But various alarming portents from heaven were proving an obstacle. There grew, in the central court of the palace, a laurel tree, its leafage holy and held in reverence for many years, which King Latinus was said to have found there when he first established the city, and dedicated the tree to Phoebus, using its name to christen his colonists the Laurentes. A strange thing happened now. A tight-packed swarm of bees came loudly humming through the limpid air, and settling upon the top of that tree, they interlocked their feet. Next moment, a swarm was hanging down from the green bough. At once the soothsayer cried, I see a stranger coming. Men are coming from where the bees came, coming to settle where the bees have settled, this fortress, their seat of empire. Apart from this, while the maiden Lavinia stood beside her father, who with ritual taper was lighting the altar, sinister thing, they beheld her long hair set on fire, and all her headdress burning with crackling flames. They saw those queenly tresses ablaze, ablaze her coronet of precious stones. Before long, enshrouded in golden, glowering, smoky flame, she was fountaining sparks all over the palace. It was counted, of course, as a dreadful, miraculous manifestation. The maiden herself, they foretold, was singled out for a famous destiny, but for the people it meant a widespread war. The king, greatly disturbed by this portent, goes to visit the oracle of Faunus, his prophet father, and questions the grove where Albunia towers over the forest, resounding with hallowed cascade and darkly exhaling a deadly vapour. Here the Italian tribes, all the Oenotrians, go for advice in times of perplexity. Hither the priestess brings the offerings, and couched at dead of night on the fleeces of the sheep sacrificed there, she woos slumber. And then visions appear to her, shapes are floating strangely about her, and in her ears are many voices. She is conversing with deity, addressing the powers of the nether regions. This was where Latinus now went to consult the oracle. After the ritual sacrifice of 100 wool-bearing sheep, he lay down and reclined upon the hides, the outspread fleeces, and at once, from the depths of the wood, a voice came. "Seek not, my son, to marry your daughter to a man of the Latin race. Embark not upon a native alliance. From abroad shall sons-in-law come, to wed our women and make our name illustrious. To their descendants the whole spinning globe shall be a footstool and an empire. All that the sun looks down on, even to the ends of the earth." The oracle of his father, Faunus, the counsel given thus in the stilly night, Latinus kept not secret. But rumour had already flown it far and wide throughout the towns of Ausonia, when the Trojan expedition lay with their vessels moored to the grassy bank of the Tiber. Aeneas, his lieutenants, and fair Ascanius sat themselves down beneath the boughs of a tall tree to have a meal. Now it happened. Jupiter prompted the action. They laid the viands on flat cakes of meal about the grass, using those cereal mats to heap the fruits of the earth on. Well, when they'd eaten all the rest, being still hungry, it befell that they turned their attention to the slender cakes of meal. With hands and teeth they were broaching incontinent those round cakes, symbol of destiny, and devouring their broad sections, when... "Goodness! We're eating our tables, too!" Ascanius cried, joking. "Just that!" But that was enough, for his words proclaimed the beginning of the end of their trials. As such, his father at once seized upon them, and struck by their God-sent meaning, would have no more said, but cried himself on the instant, "O promised land of my destiny, all hail, and all hail to you, ye gods of Troy, for you spoke truth! Here is our home. This is our country. I recall now, my father Anchises bequeathed me this secret of fate, saying, when you are come to a strange shore, and compelled by hunger, food running short, to devour your tables, that is the time to look for a home in your weariness. That is the place, mark well, to choose a site and begin to work hard on a fortified settlement." This was the hunger he spoke of. This, the last ordeal awaiting us, putting a term to our deadly perils. Come, therefore, at sunrise in high heart, let us spread out all ways from the harbour. Let us explore the interior, and investigate what manner of men live here, and where their cities are sited. Now offer libations from bowls to Jupiter, offer a prayer to my father Anchises, and set forth a good supply of wine. After these words, Aeneas, twining about his temples a leafy bough, invoked the genius of the place, and earth, first of deities. Called on the nymphs and the still unknown rivers, then called on night and the rising stars of night, Jupiter, patron of Ida, the Phrygian mother, next. Called on his parents, one in heaven, one in the underworld. Now from a clear sky did the Father Almighty thunder three times, and his own hand showed forth a cloud from heaven, a cloud that blazed and quivered with dartings of golden light. A rumour spread like magic among the rank and file, that the day had come at last to found their promised city. Exhilarated by so splendid an omen, they eagerly started the feast again, set wine and crowned the bowl. When the next day had dawned, and its early beams were lighting the earth, they went out in parties to reconnoitre the land, its city, shores and frontiers. Here, they found, was the pool of Numisius Spring, here Tiber, here dwelt the stalwart Latins. Then did Aeneas send out to the stately town of the king 100 ambassadors, chosen from every rank in his company, garlanded all with olive branches, Athene's emblem, bidden to take the king presents and to ask peace for the Trojans. At once they set off on their mission, hastening towards the palace. Aeneas himself traced out the walls with a shallow trench, and breaking the ground, threw up a rampart and battlements as for a military encampment round his first home there on the coast. Now, their journey accomplished, his emissaries drew near the walls and could see the towers and high roofs of the Latins. In front of the town were boys and youths in their first flower, practicing horsemanship and training chariot teams on the campus, or bending the lively bow, or the tough javelin hurling strenuously, and challenging one another at running or boxing. Just then, a rider brought to the ears of the long-lived king a message that some mighty men in unfamiliar livery had arrived. He orders them to be summoned to the great hall, and awaits them there on the throne of his fathers. A stately hall there was on the city's heights, a huge place of 100 soaring columns, the palace once of Laurentian Picus. It stood in a grove dark with ancestral dread. Here, to have fortunate reigns, their kings must be crowned and display first the symbols of office. This temple was senate house and scene of religious banquets alike. Here, when a ram had been sacrificed, elders were used to sit down at the long refectory tables. Here, too, in a row, were standing the statues of their forefathers, carved from old cedar wood. Italus, Father Sabinus, the planter of vines, with a pruning knife held in his carven hand, ancient Saturn and Janus facing both ways. All stood near to the entrance, with other kings from the earliest days, and heroes who had suffered wounds in defense of their country. Numerous trophies, too, were displayed on the sacred portals, chariots captured in war, battle axes with curving blades, helmet crests, huge bars from the gates of ransacked cities, javelins and shields, and beaks removed from warships. There, holding the augur's staff, arrayed in a short toga, purple-striped, the holy shield on his left arm, sat Picus, tamer of horses. Vainly lusting to bed with him, golden Circe had used her wand and her magic potions, and turned him into a bird, into a pied woodpecker. Such was the holy shrine, the ancestral hall within which Latinus sat enthroned and summoned the Trojans to him. When they had entered his presence, he began and peaceably spoke. "Trojans! Oh, yes! Your city and line are not unknown to us. We've heard of you before you sailed this way. Pray tell me what you would have. What motive, what need has brought your ships so many leagues of blue sea to these Ausonian shores? Did you mistake your course, or were you driven off it by gales? For such things often happen to men on the high seas, that you have sailed into the estuary and lie at anchor. Anyway, feel you are welcome, and know that we, the Latins, are children of Saturn. Depend on no penal system for equity, keeping from wrong our own free will in the time-honoured golden rule of that god. I indeed remember, though time has dimmed the legend, Auruncan elders telling how Dardanus was born here, and hence migrated to the towns of Phrygian Ida, and into Thracian Samos, which men call Samothrace now. His beginnings were here, in the Tuscan home of Corythus, Now he has his throne in the golden palace of the star-glistering heavens, and adds one more to the altars of the gods. Latinus had spoken. Ilioneus then made reply as follows. O king, illustrious son of Faunus, no black storm, no heavy seas it was that drove us to your country, nor did we err in our course through misreading the stars or the landmarks. By common consent, of our own volition, have we come to your city, being cast out from our empire, once the greatest the sun could see as it travelled from the very east of the sky. Jove was the first of our line. The Dardan people boasts of Jove as their ancestor. Our king, Trojan Aeneas, who sent us to you, was born of the most high stock of Jove. How terrible a storm, unleashed from cruel Mycenae, burst over the plains of Ida. How destiny compelled a war between east and west, the collision of Europe and Asia. All have heard this. It is known in remotest lands where ocean breaks on the earth's rim, known where the tyrant sun cuts off from us the dwellers in tropical countries about the equator. That storm swept Troy away. We voyaged on sea after sea. Now we but ask a small, inoffensive plot for our home gods here on the coast, with water and air that are free to all men. We shall not disgrace your kingdom. To receive us will bring you great honour amongst mankind, and win undying gratitude from us. Ausonia will never regret having taken Troy to her bosom. By the destiny of Aeneas, I swear it, and his strong right arm, trusty alike in friendship or war to whoever has tried it. Many the peoples, the nations, have willingly sought for alliance and union with us. So, do not look down on us, because now it is we who make the petition and offer the olive branch. At heaven's express command, fate's bidding, we sought out your land. From here Dardanus took his origin. Hither Apollo recalls us, strictly enjoining that we come back to Tuscan Tiber and the sacred pools of Numisius spring. Aeneas offers you, too, these gifts— small tokens of our old prosperity, relics we saved from burning Troy. A chalice of gold, which his father, Anchises, used for libations. And these, Priam's regalia when he gave laws in the old way to his assembled peoples. A scepter, a royal diadem, and vestments wrought by the ladies of Ilium. Latinus received this speech of Ilioneus with a gaze steadily fixed on the ground. He remained motionless, thinking hard, his eyes restive. It was not so much that the royal purple-embroidered robe and the scepter of Priam influenced the king, as that his mind was absorbed by the thought of his daughter's marriage and deeply pondering the oracle Faunus had given him. This, he reflected, must be the man from abroad, who is meant by the fates to become my son-in-law, and to be partner in my sovereignty. From him shall stem that future breed, excelling in courage, whose might is to master the whole world. At last, much elated, he said, "May the gods forward our project and fulfill their revelation. You shall have what you ask for, Trojan. Nor do I slight these presents. As long as I'm king, you shall not be lacking in fertile land, and Troy, as of old, shall be prosperous. Let but Aeneas come here in person. If such is his need for us, if he's eager to join us in amity and be called our ally, he must not be shy of meeting friends face to face. For me, a part of the bargain it is to shake hands with your sovereign. Do you take back, in reply, this commission of mine to Aeneas? I have a daughter, whom neither my sire's most arcane oracle nor heaven's will, expressed in many portents, permits to marry a man of her own people. Rather, they presage, For Latium is destined a prince consort from overseas, and his blood shall exalt our name to the skies. I believe it's Aeneas that fate means, and if there's any truth in my intuition, accept him. Thus spoke the king, and then chose out from the 300 beautifully groomed horses which stood in his lofty stables. For each of the envoys, there and then, he bade to be brought a courser caparisoned in crimson-embroidered trappings. Their chests were hung with perruers of gold, and gold-embroidered their housings were, and red gold the bits they champed in their mouths. To the absent Aeneas he sent a chariot and two horses of pedigree divine, breathing fire from their nostrils. They came of that mixed breed which the sorceress Circe had raised to her father, the sun, when she stole his stallions and put them to a mare. Now, with these words and gifts from Latinus, did the Trojan envoys return, proudly mounted, bearers of peace. But look! From Argos, city of Inachus, now returning, and well on her way through the sky, the vindictive consort of Jupiter saw from the air above Pachynus in Sicily, at a great distance, Aeneas triumphant, his fleet all there. She notes they have disembarked from their ships and are busily building habitations already, feeling quite safe in that land. Bitter resentment checked her. Shaking her head, she burst out, "Ah, those obnoxious Trojans, whose destiny so conflicts with the destinies of my peoples! Could they perish on Ilium's plains? Be kept in captivity when they'd been captured? Be burnt to ashes in blazing Troy? Not they! Through fire and steel they found a way of escape. I think my deity must be spent and supine, or else my rancor is sleeping from sheer satiety. Yet, when they'd been hurled out of their country, I was not slow to persecute them in their exile and oppose every stage of their voyage. Against the Trojans I spent all the might of sea and sky. What use to me were the Syrtes, Scylla, engulfing Charybdis? The Trojans are snug in Tiber's channel, their hoped-for haven, snapping their fingers at ocean and me. Yet Mars had the power to destroy the giant brood of the Lapithi. Jove himself gave over to the wrath of Diana time-honored Caledon. What had the Lapithi done, or Caledon, to deserve it? Yet I, the great consort of Jove, who have left nothing untried, who have stooped to every expedient against him, am a failure, beaten by Aeneas. Well, if my powers are not great enough, I shall not hesitate, that's sure, to ask help wherever help may be found. If the gods above are no use to me, then I'll move all hell. From his Latin kingship I may not bar him. The fates are firm that he shall marry Lavinia. So be it. What I can do is to postpone these great events, to delay them, and to wreak havoc upon the peoples of both the kings. They shall pay with their lieges' lives the price for becoming related. And you, Lavinia, Italian and Trojan blood shall be your marriage portion, and war your bridesmaid. Not only Hecuba shall have conceived a firebrand, brought forth a fire-raising bridegroom, no, Venus' son is the same, a second Paris, whose wedding taper shall be a funeral torch to resurgent Troy. When she had spoken, Juno came down to earth, horrific, and hailed forth from the infernal regions the home of the terrible deities, Alecto, maker of grief, who revels in war, in open and underhand violence, in damaging quarrels. Even her father, Pluto, and her hellish sisters loathe that fiend, Alecto. So manifold her aspects, and so ferocious each form she takes, such a nest of vipers swarms in her black hair. Now Juno began to speak, whetting this creature's appetite. Maiden, daughter of night, do me this favour. It's your kind, this service, so that our honour and reputation may not be diminished, so that the Trojans fail to wheedle Latinus by means of this marriage, or to take possession of Italy. You can set brothers of one mind at one another's throats, torment a home with hatred, bringing your whips and destructive firebrands to lash the house. You have 1,000 titles, 1,000 tricks for making mischief. Stir up your teeming ideas, disrupt the peace they have made, sow seeds of war, let them wish for weapons, demand them and use them, all in an instant. At once Alecto went, steeped in her viperish venom, and sought out first the high walls of the Laurentine monarch in Latium. There she pickets Amata's quiet threshold. The queen, whose motherly heart is seething with grief and chagrin over the Trojans' coming and the marriage with Turnus cancelled. On her the fiend now casts a serpent, one of her snake-blue tresses, and thrusts it into her bosom, deep into her heart, so that the queen may discharge through the household its maniac infection. Gliding between her dress and her smooth breasts, that serpent coils. She feels not its touch, nor notices it in her madness, breathing its morbid breath into her. Swelling, it turns into a golden necklace, into the headdress binding her hair and its pendant ribbon, and slithers over her body. Now, while that moist and magic contagion was but beginning to work upon her mind and twine her bones with fire, the queen, whose thoughts were not yet wholly possessed by the flame in her breast, quite gently spoke, as soft-hearted mothers do, greatly distressed by the thought of her daughter wedding a Trojan. "Father, must our Lavinia be wed to a Trojan, an outcast? Have you no feeling for her, no sense of your own interests, no pity for her mother? That false-hearted pirate will leave me as soon as a fair wind blows and sail away with my daughter. It's Paris all over again. Just so did Paris steal into Sparta, then carried Lydian Helen away to Troy. What of your solemn pledge, the love you had in the old days for your own people, the promise given so often to Turnus, your kinsman? If it is settled our son-in-law must be of foreign extraction, if thus your father Faunus enjoins you, I say that any land which is separate from ours and autonomous is in fact foreign. And this was what the oracle meant. Now Turnus, if we go back to the origin of his family, is Mycenaean, descended from Inachus and Acrisius." But when she saw these arguments had no effect on Latinus, and he was firmly opposed, when the serpent's frenzying poison had worked its way into her marrow and spread all over her being, then, overwrought by monstrous hallucinations, the poor queen went uncontrollably raving beside herself round the city. Just so it is that a top goes spinning under the whiplash, a top that boys, absorbed in their play, whip round an empty court in a great circle. Driven by the lash, it moves round and round, gyrating. Puzzled, in childish amazement, the boys hang over it there, and gape at the top's revolutions, livelier at every blow. So, fast and furious, the queen was driven right through the city among the inflammable populace. What's more, pretending to hear the call of Bacchus, a greater evil this, and launched her forth on a wilder madness, she flew to the woods, hid her daughter among the forested hills, to cheat of his bride the Trojan, or at least delay the marriage. "Hail, Bacchus!" she shrieked. "You alone are worthy of the maid," she kept shouting. "For you she takes up the soft-leafed Thyrsus, and you she follows in the dance, and to you is vowed the tress she is growing." The rumour flew fast. A mass hysteria swept the housewives, a burning compulsion to go and find new dwellings somewhere. they have left their homes. They are baring neck and hair to the breeze. Some of them fill the air with whimpering cries, dress up in fawn skins, and carry staves, all twined about with vine shoots. Amongst them, holding aloft a blazing torch, the hectic queen is chanting a marriage song for her daughter and Turnus. Her bloodshot eyes are rolling. Harshly, all of a sudden, she cries, "Mothers of Latium, listen, wherever you are. Do you feel in your duteous hearts any kindness for poor Amata? Does any care for a mother's rights still prick your conscience? Then loose your hair from the headband and join the revels with me." So, with the scourge of Bacchus, Alecto, who was everywhere among the trees, in the wild beast coverts, chivied the queen. When it was clear that the queen's first injection of madness was strong enough, and that Latina's purpose and household were thoroughly shaken, the lowering Alecto mounted at once on her sombre wings and made for the walls of hot-headed Turnus, the city which men say Danae founded and colonized with her Acrisians when she was driven that way by the south wind. Our ancestors called the place Ardea. Though it retains the great name of Ardea still, its best days are far behind it. Here, in the lofty palace, Turnus was taking his rest at the mid-hour of night. Alecto now sloughed off her grim looks and diabolical form, changing herself to the likeness of an old crone, uncannily furrowing her brow with wrinkles. She assumed white hair and a headband, wreathed her head with a chaplet of olive. So, as the aged priestess of Juno's temple, Calibi, coming before the young man's eyes, she spoke as follows. "Turnus, will you tolerate that all your efforts should run to waste? The dominion you've worked for pass into the hands of foreigners? The king denies you your bride, and the marriage portion you've bought with bloodshed. An alien now is called in to be his successor. Go then, you laughing stock, face dangers, mow down the Tuscans, ensure peace for the Latins. This is the thanks you get. Indeed, almighty Juno appeared in person and bade me speak to you even thus while you lay in the quiet of night. Up then! Take heart of grace, mobilize the army, march out of the gates to war. Those Trojan ships and leaders that occupy our beautiful river, burn them to ashes. These are the orders from the heavenly powers. Let King Latinus, unless he agree to stand by his word and allow your marriage, suffer for it, and discover what Turnus is like as an enemy." Here the young man in his turn began to speak, deriding her prophecy. "I am not, as you seem to think, unaware that a fleet has sailed into the Tiber. The news did come to my ears. Do not be such an alarmist, I beg you. Queen Juno is not indifferent to me and mine. As for you, mother, it's old age, clogging the mind and impairing its sense of reality, that haunts you with bogeyman worries and scares your prophetic soul with delusions of civil war. Your job's to look after the temple and the images of the gods. Leave making of war and peace to men, whose business is warfare." These words of Turnus made Alecto explode into anger. As the young prince still spoke, a sudden palsy shook him, and his eyes went stiff with fear. For the fury, hissing snake-tressed, was hideously revealed at her full height. She rolled her flaming eyes. She flung him back as he tried to falter a few more words. Two snakes stood up like horns on her head, and she cracked her whip and spoke again, her mouth like a mad dog's. "So, my mind is clogged? Old age, impairing my sense of reality, scares me with delusions of civil war? Look at me, then. I am come from the place where the Furies are. War and death I bear in this hand." So saying, she hurled an incendiary brand at Turnus, which buried itself deep in his heart, blazing and pitchily smoking. Extreme terror awoke him from sleep. A sweat broke out all over the young man's body, soaked him from head to foot. Madly yelling for alms by his bed, through his house he hunts for them. Crazy with bloodlust he is, with the criminal mania for fighting, still more with resentment. So, when a fire of wood, loud crackling, is stoked up high beneath the belly of a boiling cauldron, the water dances in the heat. Within the cauldron, the water seethes and fumes, bubbling, spitting up foam, till it cannot contain itself any more, and a cloud of dense steam rises. Breaking the peace, then, Turnus ordered his army commanders to get on a war footing and march against King Latinus. Italy must be protected, the foe thrown back from its frontiers. He would be more than a match for Trojans and Latins together. So Turnus proclaimed, and called the gods to witness his vow. The Rutuli spur one another on to war with enthusiasm, some being stirred by the youthful, handsome presence of Turnus, some by his royal lineage, some by his notable deeds. While Turnus inspired his people with the spirit of aggression, Alecto sped to the Trojans upon her hellish wings, hatching a new scheme, spying out the place where handsome Ascanius, with snares and hounds, was hunting near the seashore. Here, the devilish hag cast a sudden frenzy upon those hounds, touching their nostrils with a familiar scent, so that they ran in full cry after a stag. The beginning of trouble this was, for it kindled to war the hearts of the country folk. There was a stag, a most noble creature, with high-branched antlers, which had been taken away from its mother when young, and kept as a pet by the boys of Tyrius and Tyrius himself, the warden of the royal herds, who had charge of the pastures throughout the kingdom. Sylvia, the boy's sister, had taught the beast to obey her, looked after it, used to adorn it with soft-leafed garlands wreathed about its antlers, and groom it, and bathe it in fresh spring water. The stag was meek to her touch, and trained to its master's table. It used to rove the woods, but at night, however late it was, always could find its own way home to the well-known door. This creature, the hot-foot hounds of Ascanius, now started while it was far from home, by turns, so it happened, floating down a river and cooling itself on the verdurous bank. Ascanius, too, was immensely keen to get so glorious a prize. He bent his bow and shot an arrow. Luck was with him, his aim was true. The shaft streaked from the bowstring, viciously whirring, to pierce the stag through flank and belly. Wounded, the animal ran to hide in the well-known homestead, crept sobbing into its stall there, covered with blood, and filled the place with pathetic cries like some beseeching creature. Sylvia, the sister, striking her arms in grief, was the first to call for help, and her call brought the tough countrymen round her. They, for that virulent fury lurked in the quiet woods, were with her quicker than thought, brandishing fire-hardened stakes or bludgeons of knotty wood. Whatever came first to hand, as they angrily groped for a weapon, served them as such. Now Tyrius, panting with rage, snatched up an axe. Just then, so it happened, he was splitting an oak into four with wedges, and mustered his men. From aloft, the fell fury could see that this was the moment for mischief. She flew to the steep-pitched roof of the shippon, and perching upon it blew the rustic alarum, a blast on a crooked horn, with the full force of her demon lungs. The sound rang on, shaking the woods to their roots, through the deep forest baying. The lake of Diana heard it afar, the Nar heard it. That sallow, sulphurous river, the springs of Velinus, heard it. Terrified mothers clutched their babies to their breasts. Then, ah, then, how swift to answer the summoning call of that sinister horn. Snatching up their arms, the hardy countrymen gathered from far and wide. The warriors of Troy, at the same time, poured through the gates of their camp and hurried to help Ascanius. The two sides face each other. This is no village brawl now, to be fought out with rugged shillelaghs and fire-toughened stakes. With steel, with two-edged steel, they join issue. All over the field, darkly bristles a crop of drawn swords. Their bronze accoutrements fling the sun's challenge back, send flashes of light upwards. So, in a rising wind, white horses begin to appear on the sea's face. Then, little by little, the sea gets rougher, the waves steeper, until the sea is all mountains and valleys. Now, in the front rank, Almo, he who had been the eldest of Tyrius's sons, was laid low, hit by a whirring arrow. Deep in his throat was the wound. The arrow stuck there, and choked with blood the fluent passageway of the voice, the frail life. Around him were many corpses, old Galesus amongst them, most upright of men, and the biggest landowner once in Ausonia, killed while trying to mediate between the combatants. 5 flocks of bleating sheep he had owned, 5 herds of cattle he pastured, and 100 ploughs worked on his land. While they fought over the plain there, with neither side prevailing, Alecto, her promise fulfilled now she had given the war its baptism of blood and opened its first encounter with killings, took leave of Hesperia. Wheeling up and away through the airs of heaven, she addressed Queen Juno in tones of insolent triumph. "See, discord has been brought to fruition in stern war. Try telling them to be friends and to make a pact of peace, now that I've splashed the Trojans with blood of Ausonian men. This, too, will I add to my feats. If I am assured of your backing, I'll drag the neighbouring peoples into the war by spreading rumours and kindle their passions with the mad lust for battle, so that they all come in and the whole country's at war." Juno replied, "We have plenty enough of alarm and aggression. The reason for war is established. Already they're fighting bitterly. An accident started the quarrel, but bloodshed now has confirmed it. Let that so wonderful son of Venus, let King Latinus, celebrate thus the marriage they have arranged between them. The father, supreme lord of Olympus, would not be pleased to find you trespassing too freely here on high. Away, then. Whatever else may befall in this conflict, I myself will deal with it." Thus the daughter of Saturn spoke, and Alecto, the Fury, spreading her wings that hissed with serpents, made for her home in the underworld, leaving the height of heaven. There is a place in the heart of Italy, under the mountains, a well-known spot whose fame is told of in many countries, the Vale of Am Sanctus. On either side, steep, wooded slopes darken this vale with dense foliage, and down its middle a watercourse rumbles, eddying and clucking among the rocks. Here can be seen an awesome cave and the vents of the dreadful underworld. A great chasm formed by the upthrust of Acheron yawns, emitting a plague breath. Into it now disappeared the hateful Fury, relieving earth and sky of her presence. But the royal daughter of Saturn was still giving the war its finishing touches. The shepherds all broke from the field of battle and hurried into the city, bearing their dead with them, young Almo and Galesus, who was horribly disfigured. There they supplicated the gods and appealed to Latinus. Turnus was present, amid their angry complaints at the bloodshed, redoubling his threats. "The Trojans are called in to rule us," he shouted. "Our blood's to be mingled with Phrygian. I am debarred from the palace." Next, they whose womenfolk, possessed by Bacchus, were roving the trackless woods in their coven, great too was a martyr's influence, gathered together and clamoured importunately for war. Accursed war they will have, at once, flying in the face of omens and oracles, impelled by a power malign. A belligerent mob surrounds the palace of Latinus. He, like a sea cliff, stands resistant, inexpugnable. like a sea cliff that, when a coma comes crashing against it, stands in its massive bulk unmoved, with the wave pack yelping below it. About the reefs and the foaming rocks the sea howls impotent. Seaweed is dashed on its flanks, flung streaming back again. But when he saw he had no power to quell their purblind demand, and all was going merciless Juno's way, Latinus made many appeals to the gods, to the deaf, blind heavens. "Oh, we are pounded by doom, adrift at the storm's mercy. It is you, poor souls, who will pay in your own blood for this sacrilege. Yours is the guilt, Turnus. Punishment most severe is in store for you. Too late shall you turn to the gods with prayer. My rest is assured. I am right at the mouth of the haven, with nothing to lose but a peaceful death." Latinus said no more, but shutting himself in his palace, relinquished the reins of government. There was a custom of old in Latium, religiously kept up by the Alban townships, and now a tradition observed by Rome, mistress of empire, when first she prepares for battle, whether she goes to make war with all its tears on the Getae, the Arabs, or the Hyrcanians, or to march further east against the Indians, or get back her standards from the Parthians. There are twin gates of war. That is their name. The religion and terrible indwelling presence of Mars have sanctified them. 100 bronzen bolts and bars of durable iron secure them. Janus keeps his perpetual watch by the entrance. When the Senate has made a final decision for war, the consul, grand in Quirinal robe caught up with the Gabine cincture, himself opens these gates on their grinding hinges, in person proclaims war. The soldiers take up his cry, and the bronze trumpets blare together in hoarse accord. After this manner, Latinus was now told to declare war on Aeneas' people and open the joyless gates. But the good old king would not touch them. Turning away in revulsion from such a shocking duty, he buried himself from sight. Then did the Queen of Heaven glide down, and with her own hand roughly push open those resisting doors, dash wide upon their turning hinges the iron gates of war. Indifferent before, and lethargic, Ausonia now caught fire. Some ready themselves to march as infantry, others are mounted on tall steeds and kick up a galloping dust, all clamour to fight. What burnishing now of shields and javelin points with rich fat until they shine again? What whetting of battle axes? Their hearts are stirred to hear the trumpets and troop the colours. 5 great towns establish workshops for the production of new armaments. Powerful Atena, haughty Tiber, Ardea, Crustumerium, and turreted Antemne. Here they are fashioning helms to protect the head, manufacturing wicker frames for shields, hammering out bronze breastplates, and working polished leg guards from malleable silver. To this has come their pride in share and sickle, to this the plough's prestige. In the furnace they temper their father's swords again. Now the trumpets sound, the word goes out for war. One man hurriedly takes his helmet from store, another yokes his neighing horses, slips on the shield, the cuirass of triple-meshed gold chainmail, and straps his trusty sword on. Muses, throw Helicon wide now! Inspire me to tell the tale, to sing of the chieftains aroused to war, the ranks that followed each chieftain, packing the plains, the manhood that even in those days our bountiful Italy bloomed with, the martial array that blazed there. For you are divine, you remember it all, you can recount it, all that for me has become the faint whisper of antique story. The first to arm his men and enter the war was Mezentius, a Tuscan exile, a man embittered and irreligious. Beside him marched his son, Lausus, who far excelled all others in personal beauty except for Laurentine Turnus. Lausus, the tamer of steeds, the mighty hunter, was leading 1,000 men from the town of Agilla, an enterprise doomed to disaster. Well, he deserved to live under a better regime and to have a better father than Mezentius. After these came the handsome son of handsome Hercules, Aventinus. On the green sword he showed off his prize-winning horses and chariot bearing the victor's palm. He wore on his shield his father's blazon, the snake-clad Hydra, and 100 serpents. Him, upon the woody Aventine hill, a priestess, Rhea, brought privily forth to the light of day, when she, a mortal, had lain with a demigod, the champion from Tiryns, Hercules, who, after killing Geryon, came to the Laurentine land and dipped his Iberian cattle in the waters of Tuscany's Tiber. His men bore javelins and stabbing spears into battle, for they fought with the tapering spearhead and the short Sabine blade. Aventinus himself, on foot, swathed in a great big lion skin, shaggy and terribly bristling its hair, the white fangs grinning above his head, entered the royal palace like that, all hairy, the garment of Hercules over his shoulders. Next, twin brothers marched from the walled city of Tiber, where lived a people named after their brother, Tibertus. Catillus and mettlesome Coras they were, warriors born in Argos, and moving now in the van where the fire is hottest. Even as when two centaurs, born of the clouds, descend from some high mountain top, galloping rapidly down from Homily or snow-capped Othrys, and the great forest yields to their passage as they career and crash through the undergrowth. Siculus, too, was there, the founder of Praeneste, the king whom men throughout the ages have believed was son of Vulcan, born among flocks and herds, and found on the hearth. A yeoman regiment came straggling on behind him, warriors who dwelt in high Praeneste, or the Gabine district, where Juno is worshipped, or by the cold Anio, or in the stony Hernican brooklands, men whom fertile Anagnia reared, or the river Amasinus. Not all of them had armor, shields, or clattering chariots. Most of them used slings with bullets of light gray lead, while some carried a pair of javelins. They wore brown-colored caps of wolfskin as covering for their heads. The left foot, taking the weight of the slinger's stance, was naked, the right being shod with rawhide. Messapus, tamer of horses, the seed of Neptune, he whom no man might lay low with fire or steel, now calling all of a sudden to arms his tribes that had long been torpid and lost the habit of fighting, took up the sword again. They lived on Phesene's jagged skyline, at Phalerii the Just, in the fields of Flavinium, or the hill country of Soracte, by the lake and mountain of Ciminus, in the woodland of Capena. Evenly dressed they marched, singing their chieftain's glory. So it is when snow-white swans come winging away from their feeding ground through a way of cloud. Their necks strain forward, uttering rhythmic cries, and the water-meads of Caista sound and resound. No one would ever have thought it a multitude all made up of armored files, but rather a cloud of birds overhead, driving to land from over the deep sea with husky cries. See next how Clausus comes, of the old, pure Sabine blood, leading a mighty host, and he a host in himself. Clausus, from whom are descended the Claudian clan and family, widespread in Latium now, since Rome was shared with the Sabines. With him, a big Amiternian detachment, and men from historic Cures, and all from Eretum and olive-growing Mutusca, citizens of Nomentum, dwellers in the Rosian district around Velinium, in craggy Tetrica, Mount Severus, Casperia, Foruli, and by the river Himella. Those who drink from Tiber and Phabaris, those whom frigid Nursia sent with Autine hordes and tribes of Latium. Men whom the flood of Allia, ill-omened name, sequesters. in multitude like the waves that sweep the Libyan sea, when raging Orion sinks down below the wintry waters, thick as the ears of corn that bake in the orient sunshine over the plains of Hermus or the yellow prairies of Lycia. Shields clang, and the earth trembles with men marching in step. Next, Agamemnon's son, Halesus, who hated everything Trojan, harnessed his chariot team and brought to Turnus, post-haste, 1,000 warlike clans, hoers of the wine-rich Massic country, men whom their fathers had sent from the hills of Orunca, men who had come from the nearby